This is Dauchy's Biology, recorded the 22nd of February 2022.
Break nucleic acids. The DNA
makes protein. The DNA makes protein. The DNA makes protein.
Isn't this the coolest way to study? You're on the train on the way to school, you've got your AirPods in, look around. Everyone who sees you thinks you're listening to some cool music. Well, let's let them think that, shall we? Just nod your head and tap your foot. I won't tell them what you're really listening to if you don't. It'll be our little secret. And in the meanwhile, let's study biology. Hey there, biology fans. Welcome back for another installment of Dauchy's Biology. I'm Andrew Dauch. I had a student one year. She was a great student, but she said something at one point during the year that just seemed brilliant to me, and I've remembered it ever since, and it's actually influenced me quite a bit. She said this. She said, "The exam should measure what we've learned, but it shouldn't be the reason for learning it." Don't you love that? The exam should measure what we've learned, but it shouldn't be the reason for learning it. Every time I sit down to record a podcast, I think to myself, how much depth should I go into? Because on the one hand, I don't want to overwhelm you with information that you don't need. But on the other hand, I don't want to leave things out that are really useful. So I want to tell you a little bit about my approach here. Okay, I'm guessing that if you're listening to this podcast, you like biology, you're interested in biology. I can't imagine too many people subscribing to my podcast if they're not interested in biology. So because you're the sort of student who wants to understand biology, I think we can afford to go deeper than we might do perhaps even in class, right? Because in class, a teacher needs to, cater not only for the students who love biology, but also for students who don't like biology. I've got the luxury of really probably only speaking to the students who love biology. So I'm going to probably go deeper than your teacher might do in the classroom. And let me just say that if you don't love biology, that's okay. You can still listen to the podcast. You don't have to love biology to listen to my podcast, but I do hope that if you listen for long enough, you'll grow to love it. Anyway, nevertheless, I do have the luxury of teaching to the depth that I want to teach, and I hope that that will be really beneficial to you. But I want to make a couple of other comments about this as well. There's this idea that I hear people saying all too commonly that if something is not specifically mentioned by name in the study design, then you don't need to learn it. And I really disagree with that for a number of reasons. Firstly, the study design is extremely brief. I mean, it covers the whole of Unit 3 biology in less than a page of the study design. So clearly, it's not going into all the detail of what exactly you need to know. It says that you need to know about nucleic acids, but it doesn't say in blow-by-blow detail exactly what you need or don't need to know about nucleic acids. I guess experience as a teacher tells a teacher, the depth that's required. But that brings me to my second point, and that is that if you only understand something to the depth of the questions that are going to be on the exam, it's often really hard to interpret what the question's getting at, right? If you've only learned something to the depth that the question asks about it, it's not that you don't know the information, but it's often hard to interpret the question. You can't quite see what the question's getting at. But if you understand something much deeper than the question is asking, then it makes it really easy to know. You look at the question and you think, well, I can see exactly what it's asking. I know exactly what they're trying to get at. This is why when the exam comes out, a lot of students will come out of the exam and they'll say, I didn't know what to write for this question. And they'll show their teacher and the teacher says, oh, what they were looking for is this. Well, how does the teacher know that and not the student? Well, it's because the teacher understands biology at a deeper level than most students do. And so the teacher can look at the question and see where VCAR is coming from when they wrote the question, what they're looking for in the answer. I want to take you to a point where you can see that too. I want to take you to a point where when you look at a question, you can not only answer the question, but you can see what VCAR's getting at. You can see where the pitfalls are. You can see where other students are likely to fall into the traps and miss points. But you won't miss those points because you will have a deeper knowledge than what the question, at the level that the question is pitched at. So that's the second point. Just because something's not mentioned in the study design doesn't, I mean, it means basically, usually, if something's not mentioned in the study design, they're not going to ask a question about it on the exam. But that doesn't mean that it's not useful to understand something that's not mentioned on the study design, because knowing things at that deeper level will help you to answer questions about things that are specifically mentioned on the study design. If you understand where I'm coming from, I think that's a really important point to make. But the other thing that I want to say about this is that just because something's not specifically named on the study design, I don't think is any guarantee that it won't appear on the exam. And I can give you specific examples in previous study designs where things that have not been named specifically on the study design have been asked about on the exam. So let's go deep and make sure we really understand nucleic acids. A nucleic acid, whether DNA or RNA, is a polymer of nucleotides. That is, it's a big molecule that's a chain of lots of similar smaller molecules all linked together. All right. Now, it's a biomacromolecule. And remember, what we mean by the term biomacromolecule is it's a big molecule found in living things. And like all biomacromolecules, it's made of subunits. Those subunits are nucleotides. But not only can we say that it's a biomacromolecule made of subunits, but we can also say it's a polymer made of monomers. Okay, and the difference between those is that there are some biomacromolecules, like lipids, for example, which are big organic molecules made of subunits, but the subunits aren't arranged in a chain. Okay, so we would call them biomacromolecules and we would call their subunits subunits, but we wouldn't call them a polymer. But a nucleic acid is a polymer. It's a big long chain of its subunits. It's a big long chain of the monomers that make it up. So whether we're talking about DNA or RNA, it's a polymer made of monomers called nucleotides. So I think it probably makes sense for us to start off by talking about nucleotides. Right? Just like a polypeptide from last episode, a polypeptide is a polymer of amino acids, and every amino acid has several different moieties. Remember, we talked about how there's a carboxyl group and an amino group and a side chain. Together, they make up an amino acid, and then a polypeptide is a polymer of those amino acids. The same thing is true of nucleic acids. A nucleic acid is a polymer of nucleotides, and every nucleotide is composed of several moieties, several groups that we can also find in other molecules. Every nucleotide contains three moieties, three parts. It contains a pentose sugar, a nitrogenous base, and at least one phosphate. A pentose sugar, a nitrogenous base, and at least one phosphate. So let's just talk about those in general first, and then we'll zoom in and have a look at the nucleotides of RNA first. Okay, so first of all, let's start with the pentose sugar. What do we mean by a pentose sugar? Well, that ending O's, O-S-E, tells you that you're looking at a sugar, right? So think of all the sugar names that you know: glucose, sucrose, that's table sugar, fructose, the sugar that's in fruit. Lactose is the sugar that's found in milk. Deoxyribose, ribose. I mean, every kind of sugar pretty much ends in the ending O's. So when we talk about a pentose, we're talking about a sugar. The pent part is referring to five. Like a pentagon is a five-sided shape. A pentose is a five-carbon sugar. That's what we mean by pentose. The nitrogenous base is a base, that is, it's the opposite of an acid, right? So it's a base containing nitrogen. That's what we mean by a nitrogenous base. Some people just refer to it as a nitrogen containing base. And that's not a bad term to use, a nitrogen containing base. Personally, I like the sound of nitrogenous. It sounds great, a nitrogenous base. Sounds good. Just like I think pentose sugar sounds better than 5-carbon sugar, but you could describe it as a 5-carbon sugar, and that's perfectly fine if you prefer. And a phosphate group is phosphorus with oxygen around it. Okay, so a phosphate is phosphorus with oxygen. All right, so we've got a pentose sugar, a nitrogenous base, and phosphate. That's the basic structure of any nucleotide. Now, because the 5-carbon sugar, the pentose sugar in RNA, is slightly different to the pentose sugar in DNA, let's talk about the pentose sugar in RNA first, okay? And then we'll talk about the pentose sugar in DNA. And we'll do this for the sugar and the base as well, right? So let's start with RNA. Now, if you're looking at a picture of ribose, which is the 5-carbon sugar, the pentose sugar in RNA. And by the way, the RNA stands for ribonucleic acid because the word ribo is referring to ribose, which is the pentose sugar found in RNA. All right, no surprises for guessing that deoxyribose is the 5-carbon sugar, the pentose sugar found in DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. All right, but we're focusing here on RNA and its 5-carbon sugar, ribose. Now, if you're looking at a picture of it, ribose looks like a shopping trolley. Every time I look at ribose, I think, boy, that looks like a shopping trolley. You may want to just pause the podcast, go and Google a picture of ribose, and you'll see what I mean. It looks once you've seen it, you can't unsee it. It looks like a shopping trolley. It's kind of a basket-shaped molecule. If you imagine a basket made of carbon, someone's bought oxygen and there's oxygen in the basket, right? So you're looking at a carbon basket with oxygen in it. It's got two wheels made of oxygen and it's got a handle which is made of another carbon. Right, so if you're not looking at a picture, can you kind of picture that in your head? Picture a carbon-shaped basket made of four carbons, okay, a four-carbon basket with two oxygen wheels and a handle also made of carbon. That's what ribose looks like. Now, attached to the handle is a phosphate group. Okay, so there's that 1/5 carbon sticking up there that's the handle of the shopping trolley. Attached to that, that's where the phosphate is. On the front of the basket, right, and so the opposite end of the basket to the handle, that's where the nitrogenous base is attached. All right, so again, you know, there's a whole lot of hydrogen in there as well. You don't really need to worry about that. But again, pause, go and have a look at a picture of ribose and you'll see what I mean. And it's actually a really useful mental image to have of ribose as well, because if you're looking at a pentose sugar and it's deoxyribose, okay, the kind of sugar found in DNA, if it's deoxyribose, it looks exactly the same except that the front wheel of the shopping trolley is missing. Okay, that oxygen that forms the front wheel of the shopping trolley is gone, hence the name deoxyribose. It's the same as ribose, but it's missing an oxygen, and the oxygen that is missing is the front wheel of the shopping trolley. All right, as I said, it's a stupid thing to say, but go and have a look at a picture and you'll see exactly what I mean. And once you've seen it, you can't unsee it. You'll know the structure of ribose every time you see it. As far as the nitrogenous bases are concerned, there are 5 of them. 4 of them we find in DNA, and 3 of those are the same in RNA, but there's one different one as well. Let's start by talking about DNA, shall we? When we're talking about the nitrogenous bases. The 4 bases that we find in DNA are adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine. Adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine. So those are the 4 bases. So every nucleotide, every DNA nucleotide has deoxyribose, right? So that's the pentose sugar. It has phosphate, and it also has one of adenine, thymine, cytosine, or guanine. Now, RNA, on the other hand, remember, of course, it has a ribose sugar, and then attached to that is, again, one of 4 bases, either cytosine or guanine or adenine, but this time, not thymine, but uracil. Okay, so they're exactly all of them, DNA, RNA, both of them can have adenine, guanine, cytosine. But RNA, instead of having thymine, has uracil. And uracil and thymine look very, very similar to each other. Like structurally, they're very, very similar. And it's just that if the sugar is ribose instead of deoxyribose, then uracil will attach to that first carbon rather than you know, thymine. So that's the only difference. Now, let's think about those five bases: adenine, guanine, cytosine, uracil, and thymine. Adenine and guanine are what we call purines, and that means that they've got two carbon rings in their structure. Cytosine, uracil, and thymine are what we call pyrimidines, or pyrimidines, if you like. That's how it's spelled, with a P-Y-R, like a pyramid. Cytosine, uracil, and thymine are pyrimidines. They only have one carbon ring in their structure. And there's an easy way, I think, to remember this. The way I remember the difference is I imagine a really sharp-edged pyramid. Can you imagine that in your mind? A really sharp-edged pyramid. The edges have to be really sharp in this mental picture that you're forming of a really sharp-edged pyramid. And I want you to imagine running your fingers down the edge of that sharp-edged pyramid, and it's so sharp that it cuts your fingers. Can you imagine the blood coming out? If you've got that mental image in your head, then you have just remembered which of the bases are purines and which are pyrimidines, because you cut your finger on a pyramid, all right? And the letters C-U-T, cytosine, uracil, thymine, spell out cut. You cut yourself on a pyramid. So cytosine, uracil, and thymine are the pyrimidines, and the other ones, adenine and guanine, those are the purines, okay? Now, while we're talking about the bases, it's worth saying that these bases can pair with other bases. We call it complementary base pairing. When two bases come near each other, they will often stick together. They'll actually form hydrogen bonds between them. Because of the position of their oxygens and their hydrogens, the hydrogens and oxygens are just in the right place that they'll form these weak hydrogen bonds, these weak forces of attraction between one base and another complementary base. And when I say complementary, that's exactly what I mean. It's not complementary. It doesn't mean, you know, like complementary with an I. That means saying nice things to somebody. You're being complementary. No, we mean complementary. That is, their oxygens and hydrogens are just in the right place that they'll form hydrogen bonds. They have the right shape to pair with each other. And it turns out, and you need to know which bases pair with which, okay? You probably don't really need to know which ones are purines and which are pyrimidines. That's useful. I mean, it's helpful to know, I think, for your own knowledge. It's not going to be on the exam, I wouldn't imagine. But which bases pair with which other bases almost certainly will be on the exam. You absolutely need to know which bases pair with which other bases. Adenine and thymine pair together. Adenine and thymine are complementary bases. Now, of course, adenine, remember, is a purine, and thymine is a pyrimidine. And in every case, a purine pairs with a pyrimidine. Okay, that's always the case. So adenine and thymine will form a complementary base pair. And of course, if it's RNA, adenine and uracil will form a complementary base pair, because remember, uracil kind of like is like thymine, is just a slight variation on the theme of thymine. So uracil or thymine will always pair with adenine. And that's not a bad way of remembering it, because people often get muddled up and they can't remember whether uracil pairs with adenine or thymine. They know that there's kind of one of them switched around. But a nice way of remembering it for yourself is that uracil and thymine both pair with adenine. Uracil and thymine both pair with adenine. Guanine and cytosine always pair with each other, okay? So whether it's DNA or RNA, guanine and cytosine pair with each other, and uracil and thymine both will pair with adenine, all right? So that's as far as those nitrogenous bases are concerned. All right, let's just go back to the sugar again, because there's something else I want to tell you about that pentose sugar. And whether we're talking about DNA or RNA, it doesn't make any difference. Or whether we're talking about deoxyribose, I should say, or ribose, it doesn't matter. This is true of both of those pentose sugars. We number the carbons in the pentose sugar, and we start with where the base is attached. That is the front of the shopping trolley. That's where we start numbering. So that first carbon we call 1 prime. That's like 1 with an apostrophe on it. The second carbon, which is the front bottom of the shopping trolley basket, we call 2 prime. The third carbon, which is the bottom of the basket at the back of the shopping trolley, we call 3 prime. The top of the basket at the back, we call 4 prime. The carbon that makes the handle of the shopping trolley, we call 5 prime. That's 5 apostrophe. Okay, so there's the 5 carbons. We number them from the front of the shopping trolley, down the basket, across the base of the basket, up the back of the basket, up to the shopping trolley handle. 1 prime, 2 prime, 3 prime, 4 prime, 5 prime. And you might think, well, who cares? Well, I'll tell you who cares. You care. And the reason is that you'll often read about DNA having a 5 prime end and a 3 prime end. And all that's talking about is the direction of the nucleotides that make up the polymer of DNA. The 5 prime end is where the shopping trolley handle is, right? It's the 5th carbon end. And the 3 prime end of a nucleotide is at the bottom of the shopping trolley. So because you have this strand of nucleotides, this polymer of nucleotides, at one end of that polymer, there will be an exposed 5 prime carbon, and at the other end of the polymer, there'll be an exposed 3 prime carbon. That's the 3 prime end of that whole polymer. All right? And that's really important because as we go further on, when we're looking at transcription and all sorts of other things throughout the course, I'm going to be talking about the 5 prime end and the 3 prime end. I mean, you need to know, for example, that messenger RNA goes into a ribosome 5 prime end first. Well, of course, you need to know what that means, okay? When we're talking about RNA polymerase building a strand of RNA, it always adds nucleotides to the 3 prime end. You know, you need to know what that means when we get to that. So it's worth learning it now. It's worth knowing what we mean by those now. And if you're wondering, why do we call it the 1 prime, 2 prime, 3 prime? Why do we call it 1 with an apostrophe, 2 with an apostrophe? Why don't we just call it 1, 2, 3, 4? Well, the reason is that we use the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4 in the base, right? Now, we don't talk about them in this course. This is the last time we'll ever talk about that. But that's the reason, right, is that because there are these two, you know, the ribose sugar and the nitrogenous base are both moieties of a nucleotide. We use the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. in the base, so we can't use them in the sugar as well. And the reason we use them in the base is because the base is bigger, right? So we use 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in the biggest moiety and 1 prime, 2 prime, 3 prime, 4 prime in the second biggest moiety, which is the ribose or the deoxyribose. Now, as I said, at the 5 prime end, because see how I can use that language now, at the 5 prime end of the ribose, we can say that there's a phosphate there. Sometimes there's more than one phosphate. Like there's this fantastic molecule. It's actually my favorite molecule. I think it's important to have a favorite molecule. My favorite is ATP, adenosine triphosphate. And adenosine triphosphate is a nucleotide, but it has 3 phosphates, not just one. So it's still got ribose. It's still got adenine, hence adenosine. Right, so adenosine is adenine with a sugar, adenosine, right? But on the 5th carbon, there is a chain of 3 phosphates, adenosine triphosphate. Okay, beautiful. And by the way, just that name, adenosine, just so you know, right? Because, you know, you want to, you know, again, this is far more detail than you probably really need, but it's so useful in deepening your understanding. Adenosine, right, that term, adenosine, what they've done to name it is they've taken adenine, right, and stuck an O's in it to tell you that the adenine is stuck to a sugar, right? It's aden, like adenine, but adenosine telling you it's adenine with a sugar. Adenine with a ribose sugar is called adenosine. And then because it's got 3 phosphates, adenosine triphosphate. All right, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. All right, we'll talk more about ATP, adenosine triphosphate, in other lessons. But for now, we're not really focusing on it. Although it's a nucleotide, we're focusing on DNA and on RNA. Beautiful. As I said before, the phosphate is a phosphorus with oxygen. All right, so we've covered what nucleotides are like, what the structure of a nucleotide is like. Let's talk about DNA, shall we? Let's start by talking about DNA, and then we'll talk about the different kinds of RNA as well. All right, firstly, DNA is a double-stranded molecule. That is, it contains two strands, two chains of nucleotides, okay? And the thing about those two chains is they're held together by complementary base pairings. So on one strand, everywhere there's a guanine, on the other strand, there is a cytosine. Everywhere on one strand, there's a thymine, on the other strand, there's an adenine, and so on. All right, so these complementary base pairs hold the two strands of DNA together by hydrogen bonds. Three hydrogen bonds between cytosine and guanine, and two hydrogen bonds between adenine and thymine. Now, that might seem like an unimportant thing, but again, it's not. And when you're learning about the trip operon, it actually becomes important to know that there are only two bonds between adenine and thymine, but three bonds between cytosine and guanine. And the relevance of that is that three bonds is stronger than two bonds. So adenine and thymine are not held together as strongly as cytosine and guanine. If you've got a piece of DNA that's got a lot of adenine and thymine in it, it's not going to be held together as strongly as if there's a whole lot of cytosine and guanine in there. All right, because only two-thirds as strong. The bond between adenine and thymine is only two-thirds as strong as the bond between cytosine and guanine. All right, so it's double-stranded, but even though it's double-stranded, the strands run in opposite directions. Okay, we say that DNA is anti-parallel. The structure of DNA is anti-parallel because the two strands run parallel to each other like train tracks, but they go in opposite directions. One strand, if you're looking at a DNA running from the left to the right, one strand runs in a 5' to 3' direction, the other strand runs in a 3' to 5' direction. You know, they're running parallel, but in opposite directions. We say that they are anti-parallel is the term that we use for that. All right, very good. And also, of course, DNA is twisted. Okay, so it spirals around, and people often refer to that structure as a double helix. Double, of course, because it's two strands of nucleotides, and helix because the word helix means a spiral. We see that in words like helicopter, all right? So it's a helix, it's a spiraling. People often describe it as a twisted ladder, okay, is the structure of DNA. All right, let's think about RNA now. Now, there are three different types of RNA. And then there are a few other words that people attach to RNA as well. But the three main types of RNA that you need to be aware of are messenger RNA, transfer RNA, and ribosomal RNA. Messenger RNA is the RNA that gets read from DNA by the enzyme RNA polymerase. So during gene expression, and we'll make a whole episode about gene expression, but during gene expression, when DNA in the nucleus is read into, you know, in order to make a protein out in the cytoplasm, the DNA is unwound and unzipped by an enzyme called RNA polymerase, which runs along adding complementary RNA nucleotides to the DNA. That molecule is called messenger RNA. Okay, so RNA polymerase synthesizes a molecule called messenger RNA, and it's called messenger RNA because it's basically a copy of one of the strands of DNA. All right, so messenger RNA is a copy of one of the strands of DNA. Now this gets a little bit complicated, okay? Right, because the strand of DNA which is used to make the messenger RNA, the strand of DNA that the RNA polymerase runs along using that to make the messenger RNA is called the template strand because it's used as a template to make the messenger RNA. The other strand of DNA is called the complementary strand of DNA. Now that so far makes perfect sense, right? Because we're using one of the strands as a template. The other strand is complementary to the template. So far, so good. But some people refer to the strands, instead of calling them the template strand and the complementary strand, they call them the coding strand and the non-coding strand. But people get very confused about this. right? Because they assume that the coding strand would be the template strand and the non-coding strand would be the complementary strand, right? Because after all, you'd expect the coding strand would be the one that's read by the RNA polymerase, right? It's the one that's being read with the coded instructions for making proteins. But it's the other way around. The template strand, the strand that the RNA polymerase runs along to make messenger RNA, that strand is the non-coding strand. And the complementary strand, that is the coding strand. And the reason why it's that way around is because in messenger RNA, a group of three nucleobases, like, you know, a group of three nucleotides, is called a codon. Okay, so we talk about, you know, messenger RNA is read by a ribosome in nucleotide triplets called codons, three codons at a time, three bases at a time, or one codon at a time, right? So messenger RNA contains codons. The coding strand of the DNA has codons. The coding strand of the DNA is the same as the messenger RNA. They are both a positive sense strand. Okay, so everywhere the messenger RNA has cytosine, the coding strand also has cytosine. Everywhere the messenger RNA has guanine, the coding strand also has guanine. Whereas the template strand is the opposite. The template strand has it's the anti-sense strand. It's not the positive sense strand, it's the negative sense strand. And that the RNA polymerase is using that kind of as an inverse template to make a strand of messenger RNA, which is actually a copy of the coding strand. It's a copy of the complementary strand. If you can picture that, you're doing very well. It's kind of hard to talk about this without a diagram. But if you look at a picture of DNA, you see the RNA polymerase attached to the template strand, and you look at the sequence of bases, you'll notice that the template strand, everywhere it's got an adenine, the complementary strand has a thymine, and the messenger RNA has a uracil. Well, thymine and uracil are kind of the same. Everywhere the template strand has a guanine, the complementary strand has a cytosine, and so does the messenger RNA. Everywhere the template strand has a cytosine, the complementary strand has a guanine, and so does the messenger RNA. So the messenger RNA is really the same. It's a copy of the coding strand, or a copy of the complementary strand, not the template strand. All right, so that's confusing. If you use the I would probably recommend that you use the term template strand and complementary strand rather than coding and non-coding strands, because I think those terms tend to be confused a lot more. But if your textbook or what you're reading on the internet uses the term coding strand, just remember that that means the same as the complementary strand. All right, fabulous. Now, that's messenger RNA, right? So, and it's called messenger RNA because it leaves the nucleus, goes out into the cytoplasm, carrying the code from the DNA out to the ribosome, ready to be translated at the ribosome. Okay, now, translation happens when a second kind of RNA called transfer RNA comes down to the ribosome. Every transfer RNA molecule carries an amino acid. And the amino acid that it carries is specific to that transfer RNA. A transfer RNA with a three-base sequence, an anticodon that reads GAC, for example, will always carry the amino acid leucine. A transfer RNA with the anticodon AGC always codes for serine. All right, so every transfer RNA has a specific amino acid and a sequence of three bases sticking downwards called an anticodon. Of course, the anticodon is the opposite of the codon. So, you know, a transfer RNA with the anticodon, say, AAA, will pair with the messenger RNA where there's a codon UUU, all right? That complementary AAA and UUU, they're going to pair together because they're complementary bases. So the anticodon AAA will pair with the codon UUU. Transfer RNA is like messenger RNA is a single strand of nucleotides. It's a polymer, but a single chain of nucleotides, but it's kind of bent and folded into a sort of a clover-leafed shape. As I said, at one end, it's got an amino acid. At the other end, three exposed bases that we call an anticodon. Ribosomal RNA is also a kind of RNA. That is, it's a single strand of nucleotides, a single stranded nucleic acid, but it forms a large part of ribosomes. In fact, the ribosome is about 60% ribosomal RNA and 40% protein. So roughly half and half, pretty much, isn't that? So a ribosome is largely made of ribosomal RNA. It's kind of beautiful, isn't it, when you think about it, because all three of these kinds of RNA are synthesized from DNA. They're all transcribed from DNA in different parts of the nucleus, right? So that's where, I mean, we know the messenger RNA is copied from the DNA using the enzyme RNA polymerase. But that's true also of transfer RNA, and it's true of ribosomal RNA as well. In fact, when you've looked in, you know, a microscope and you've looked at a cell and you see the nucleus of the cell, there's often a dark staining splotch. There's a dark staining spot in the nucleus called the nucleolus. Well, what that nucleolus is it's the place in the nucleus where DNA is being transcribed into ribosomal RNA. That's where the ribosomal RNA comes from, is the nucleolus within the nucleus. So all three kinds of RNA are transcribed from the DNA in the nucleus. And then they all go out into the cytoplasm and they kind of meet up in this romantic rendezvous where they all come together, you know, the ribosome made largely of ribosomal RNA, and into that feeds the messenger RNA, and then transfer RNAs come down and pair with the messenger RNA at the ribosomal RNA. It's kind of the meeting of all three kinds of RNA that were all transcribed from the nucleus and moved out to different places in the cytoplasm, and they all come back together for the purpose of protein synthesis. Isn't it? It is kind of beautiful. It sort of sends a bit of a chill down your spine just thinking about how that works, doesn't it? Now, before we end our discussion about RNA, I just want to mention that there are a couple of other times through the year that you're going to encounter RNA with a different name. When you're learning about CRISPR, you'll learn about RNA, little short sequences of RNA that are held by the Cas9 enzyme. You may have already started learning about this, I don't know, but if not, you will come across it. These little short sections of RNA that are held by Cas9 enzymes that are referred to either as sgRNA or crRNA. So sg, that's little s, little g, then capital RNA. What that stands for is short guide RNA. If you see it written as crRNA, again, that's little c, little r, then capital RNA. crRNA, that stands for CRISPR RNA. They mean the same thing. And depending on the text, you'll see it written as either sgRNA or crRNA. Either way, that's that little section of RNA that's held in the Cas9 enzyme in CRISPR. And if you haven't got up to learning about CRISPR yet, don't freak out. You'll see it when you get to it. I just want to make the point that that sgRNA, it is messenger RNA. It's not really any different to any other messenger RNA. It just gets a special name because it's used in a special way by that Cas9 enzyme. Okay. In the next episode of this podcast, I want to talk about gene structure and the TRIP operon. So we're going to be looking at that in the next episode. But before I get to that, I just want to respond to an email that came in from a listener following the last episode of the podcast. It was a listener whose name was Renee. And I'm paraphrasing the question because it was quite long. But basically this was following up from the podcast on proteins. She was saying, you know, at what point are methyl groups added? Are they added sort of during translation, or are they added later on? You know, these post-translational modifications, at what point does that happen? And the answer to that question is it's going to happen at some point after translation. I mean, the second part to her question, by the way, is that how does the cell know to change between the levels of structure, you know, secondary structure, tertiary structure? And so maybe I didn't paint a very good picture of this in the last episode. So let me just clarify that. And I think that will probably answer Renee's questions. Is that when the polypeptide is synthesized, okay, from the things we were talking about today, right? So messenger RNA feeds through a ribosome, 5' end first. and then the transfer RNA molecules come down to that ribosome, bringing their amino acids together, and the amino acids all get linked together by peptide bonds to form a polypeptide. As that's happening, that polypeptide chain, that polymer of amino acids, is going to start folding up because of the interaction between neighboring side chains on those amino acids. It's going to start bending and folding instantly. Alpha helices are going to start forming, you know, even while translation is still happening. As that polypeptide feeds out of the ribosome, it's going to start rolling up into alpha helices and forming beta pleated sheets and random coils. All that secondary structure, that's going to happen like spontaneously, even while translation is still continuing a little bit further down the polypeptide chain, right? Before translation is even finished, the parts that have finished being translated are going to start coiling up and forming beta-pleated sheets and stuff, forming that secondary structure. The tertiary structure, though, that is that three-dimensional shape of the polypeptide, that is part of, you know, I mean, that's the result of what we call post-translational modification. It's where these chaperone proteins come in and bend the polypeptide into its precise three-dimensional shape, and protease enzymes cut the polypeptide, cut bits off it or whatever, where several different polypeptides get added together to make a protein with quaternary structure, where methyl groups get added and acetyl groups get added and metal ions get added and all this other stuff that happens. And, you know, you don't really need to know any of those in particular detail. Just know there's a whole lot of stuff that happens to that protein. But that's going to happen following translation, all right? So once the ribosome has come out, once the polypeptide rather has come out of the ribosome, it'll already be sort of, its secondary structure will form already spontaneously, but that tertiary structure happens only after translation is finished and that polypeptide is then modified by other proteins in the cell. And maybe I didn't explain that particularly well in the last episode. One other thing that I just want to point out about that too, while we're talking about it, is that if proteins get heated up too much, they can be denatured. If you heat up a protein, and this is actually pretty important when you're thinking about things like enzymes, if you heat up a protein too much, it's what will happen is that heat causes the molecule to vibrate so much that hydrogen bonds start to break and the protein loses its tertiary structure. It loses its three-dimensional shape. And there's no reason to think that it would go back into that tertiary structure. It would regain its tertiary structure, go back into its three-dimensional shape, its precise three-dimensional shape, because it didn't just spontaneously form that three-dimensional shape in the first place. It was put into shape by these other proteins in the cell. So if it gets damaged, if it gets denatured by extremes of heat, it won't go back into its regular shape again. It'll be permanently changed. And that's what we mean by the term denatured, if you've come across that. So thanks for your question, Renee. I hope I've answered it. You know, Renee actually asked several different questions, but they were all getting to this point of, you know, in what sequence does this happen? Okay. So again, the primary structure forms is just the sequence of amino acids. Secondary structure is the way that it folds up natively, spontaneously, because these side chains interact with each other. But then the tertiary structure, that happens only after translation, once these other proteins have modified it. So look, and thank you for sending in the question. If you, as a listener, have a question, something you'd like to ask about this or any other episode of the podcast, I'd invite you to send an email to biologypodcast@gmail.com. That's all one word, biologypodcast@gmail.com. And I'll talk about your question in the next episode of the podcast. Thank you so much for listening. It's only because you listen that I make the podcast. I'll see you back here in the next episode.